This podcast is brought to you by Liquidware. Liquidware is the leader in adaptive workspace management solutions for Windows desktops. Their products cover all facets of management to ensure the ultimate user experience across all workspaces, physical, virtual, DAS, or cloud.
At the third stroke, it will be...
Hello and welcome to EUC Digest, your bi-weekly audio snack on everything EUC related. In today's show, we'll be talking about how to avoid the common VDI and DAS mistakes. But before we dive into this topic and the pitfalls of these solutions, please allow us to introduce ourselves. My name is Erik van Klaveren, and I'm your host for this episode. And with me in the air is Jits, how are you doing these days?
I'm great, great to be on the show back. Great to be back on the show again. So yeah, I have to warm up, right? I have to amp up.
It's been a while.
yeah, for sure. And while you were doing the intro, your bi-weekly audio snack. So bi-weekly, we gave it a little bit of a stretch during the summer period.
Right? Yeah, so. Yeah. Sorry about that.
we'll catch up. We'll catch up. So
eventually.
Yeah. We'll do. So, looking forward to this one.
You did your homework. What did you find out about our guests?
Well, we have two guests today, right? So,
Yeah.
And, one of them was our first guest in this series of podcasts. And you might remember him as the spiritual father of the fiber over bamboo concept. And does it ring any bells? But our second guest is a true patriarch of end-user computing, a true community member, but more importantly, maybe also a founder of many communities as we know them today. So, since we are seeking interesting facts, I have, digged up a couple of things. So did you know that he is famous for bringing his Dutch trope bubbles across the entire globe? But there is actually a reason why he brings his trope bubbles.
You're going to explain, right?
Yes, yeah. So when he's traveling, and he, before COVID-19, of course, he did his fair share of traveling. But every once in a while, there are some pickpockets trying to steal his backpack with his passport. And always, these guys ask ransom, right? Ransom in stroopwafels. So that's basically it's his way to survive while he is traveling. And sometimes his stroopwafels even can get him into Comic-Con. So who knows?
Wow. Well, if you still don't know who our guests are, please, guests. And I will start with the guy who invented fiber over bamboo. Introduce yourself.
Hi, my name is Rodi Kosse. I've been on the first episode.
Yeah, you were.
Exactly. Yeah, pre-COVID. So we could sit tightly together, but this is a different setting. Cool to be here.
Awesome. You're back in our show again. Yeah. And of course, we said we have two guests. The other one who pays his ransom in stroopwafels. Can you introduce yourself?
Yep. My name is Ruben. For the Dutch guys, Sprite with a rolling R, but US colleagues will call me Sprite, which is fine for me. All good. just Ruben for friends.
Cool. Both, thank you for being on our show. But could you please explain to our listeners who you are, like you already did actually, but what you do and where people might recognize you from?
Besides stroopwafels.
Yeah.
Yeah, Rodi, go ahead. Yeah. Take it away.
Yeah. As Jit said, I think made a famous speech about fiber over bamboo, but most of you might know me in the Netherlands as a consultant at PQR. I'm also Citrix C2P and part of the NVIDIA NGCA program. I like to speak on various events, mostly about user experience, and we'll talk about that also today. So that's me, a geek.
Awesome. Yep,
that's indeed a good one. Geek, that fits to me as well. Like, I'm a technologist at Nutanix. Joined Nutanix through Frame acquisition. Before Frame, working for a storage startup in California, and then spent probably 13 or close to 13 years for PQR as CTO and architect. So background is end-user computing, IT, technology, feet on the ground, geek, and also community member, community friend. I like to work together with many community people and build communities, support communities. And yeah, in the Citrix, Microsoft, VMware, NVIDIA, and the ecosystem around that. That's my piece of cake. That's what I like.
It's a pretty long list, right?
Yep.
It's amazing. So you are going to do a session by the end of September, which is called 5 VDI DAS Mistakes and How to Avoid Them. Anybody want to elaborate on that? What's it going to be
sure.
Before we dive into the details from everything?
Yep. Yeah. So Rodi and I, we had the plan and we have the plan to talk about these mistakes. And first we came together and said, okay, let's write down the mistakes. And we created a sort of a list of 10 mistakes, but that was a little bit too much. So we said, let's focus on the top 5 and it should be like close to in an hour. It's an event organized by Nutanix, but it's not about Nutanix content per se. It's just like VDI, DAS, Citrix, Microsoft, VMware, Amazon, Nutanix, like the whole ecosystem. And we, and the same applies for both you two as well, we have a lot of knowledge in this space. And our goal is just to educate listeners working with VDI and desktop as a service, or maybe new to that space, to make them successful with these implementations. So we share the 5 mistakes, which are like sizing and optimizing, discussion around single user, multi user. That's the second topic. The third topic is about data locality or data strategy. Third topic. The fourth topic is around like VDI, virtual desktop infrastructure, which can mean different things to different people, but like software, like we know and use for many years, and DAS, so VDI and DAS in public cloud and on-prem, with a lot of conversations about when to use public cloud, when to use on-prem. And the fifth topic is around user experience and network bandwidth. So 5 cool topics with a lot of great content
to discuss.
Yes. Yeah.
Can the two of you explain what's the difference between DAS against virtual desktop?
Yeah, that's a good one. So VDI can mean different things to different people. Rory and I, we had a lively conversation earlier today about that. So in this context, and in the context of like our session, we define VDI as software. So the platform, the knowledge, the skills to size, to design, to install, like implement and operate a platform to run apps and desktops, which can be single user, multi-user, client OS, server OS, like these items combined. But the core message, it's software. The control plane, the broker, is software. That's like the VDI approach. And the DAS approach, the key differentiation there is that the control plane, the broker, is not software, but is a service you consume. And the broker on VDI is software, and the broker on DAS is a service. And then the workload machines, the workers to run apps and desktops, in the VDI context, mostly are like on-prem or in a co-location from a partner, these type of infrastructures. And on the DAS side, it's often public cloud, but it also depends which kind of DAS vendor you use for your platform. It can also be on-prem or a mixture of on-prem and public cloud. So you have control plane, that's one key element, software versus service. And then you have your workload machines, which can be single user, multi-user, server OS, client OS, and that's like the workload machines on-prem or in public cloud.
So in essence, to summarize, with a VDI environment, you were both in charge of, with you, the organization who was offering the VDI to the employees within the organization, for example. You need to build the entire infrastructure with all the supporting components, as well as the virtual desktops, of course, servicing the applications and access to data to the employees within the organization. And with a DAS solution, you're simply consuming this this desktop, but you still need to install and configure all your applications within the as a service platform.
That's one of the topics Rodi and I talked about, like from an like Nutanix or Citrix or VMware or Microsoft or like Amazon perspective, like vendors and partners, friends, sometimes competitive, but that doesn't matter. They all deliver sort of the platform. But if you ask Rodi working for PQR, they also deliver a DAS service to their clients. So the term DAS can mean different things to different people, because for Rodi and his clients, or for another system integrator or another MSP, the DAS service is like the complete solution, including apps, including support, including like the whole package. So and they could use Citrix or they could use another platform to help them with that.
Yeah, and we can even consume another DAS solution, right? So we can use Frame or Citrix Cloud or VMware Cloud Service. Yep. And we bring it as a DAS to our customers, but then with package with their applications fully updated and so forth. So
it's good to know what is and isn't like done by the DAS vendor. Like, who is the DAS vendor? Is that like an MSP or is it like Microsoft? And who is responsible for what? Is that antivirus updates, Windows updates, application installs, like the whole package? And that type of conversation fits in like the DAS topic. But as Eric asked, hey, what is the difference between VDI and DAS? Historically, we all four are grown up in like the VDI space, and like the long-term EUC gigs. We talk about server-based computing and terminal services and multi-user. We talk about single-user and VDI. But what we see is that the technology combined more often is called VDI, while we as EUC geeks don't agree with that because we know VDI is like could be something else. That's sometimes challenging, but that's why it's important to explain.
So, Ruben, when you started off with explaining what VDI was, you mentioned, VDI is something that we design and you need to size. But this applies to a DAS solution as well, right? But maybe this is done by someone else instead of the consumer, of course. But in both solutions, you still need proper sizing, right? And design phase.
Yep, but different as well, because the focus will be different. When we talk about sizing, in the context of your question means like workload machines sizing. What kind of machines do you use? What kind of infrastructure do you use? How many CPUs? What's the overcommit ratio? What's the vGPU profile? That type of sizing applies to both VDI and DAS.
As well as how you define your workloads and how they should scale. Where that's located. Is this one of the many mistakes you address?
Yeah, sizing is one of the mistakes we address.
Least it offers a huge opportunity to make mistakes. In the webinar extract, you mentioned one of the topics, as Ruben mentioned during the introduction, Rodi, is how to right size and optimize your virtual desktops and applications. How do you determine how much CPU, RAM, GPU, and storage you need? So, that's the question that you ask in the abstract, of course. But can you? And I know this webinar is scheduled on September 30. So don't want to steal any your own thunder, right?
But
for the two listeners that we have, Rodi, can you please answer your own question?
Yeah. Well, to create a good sizing which fits your organization, you need to have some knowledge, right, of the topics you're talking about. So what means CPU overcommitment? So in the webinar, we don't have the time to tell about overcommit ratios, for example, but we will give people some resources so they can learn more about these topics as well. If we talk in NVIDIA terms, like vGPU profiles, right? What does that mean for an end user in sizing? So that's one of the parts you need to have knowledge about, but other things is what's your baseline? What's your current environment doing? So use the correct tooling to get a baseline of what you have and then set the correct requirements and what you want and test if what you will get is what is better than your current situation. So, and that's all by using the correct tooling.
Yeah, and I think there is a major difference in whether this is in your own data center or it's in cloud. as well as is this a resource or a workload that I'm consuming that's multi-user, or is it supposed to be for single use?
Yeah, yeah. And one of the topics that you should not forget is how to properly size, for example, Windows 10. Because people still look at Windows 10 as the same, in the same way they looked at Windows 7, right? So Windows 7, the first release and the end release is not that different. They got, it's one service pack, some patches.
But I hated it at first, Windows 7, and I loved Windows 10 Instant.
Cool. I hated the update mechanism, but that's another thing. but Windows 10, every 6 months, it's get a major feature update. And that behaves differently. It consumes different kinds of the amount of RAM or CPU usage can be different. So you need to recheck every time you're sizing if it still fits.
But especially in a traditional VDI environment, right? Size an environment for not for tomorrow or next week, but for the upcoming, I don't know, 3, 4, maybe 5 years.
Yeah.
So how what would you advise to any architect out there that is in the phase of sizing and designing a new Windows 10 environment? Oversubscribe?
Look at the CPU sizing. So never go higher than 70-80% currently. So if you size your environment, keep a reserved part for future growth. So if the CPU usage is higher in the future, you still have some headroom left. So never size at 90% CPU usage, for example.
And also, I don't believe you can size for the next 5 years.
No.
Because, from an application usage perspective, you don't know what will happen in the next 5 years. Look at what happened last 6 months. The adoption of unified comms increased big time.
Yep.
And that can have a huge impact in just resource consumption, both in on-prem and public cloud. Like Eric mentioned, how to size on-prem and public cloud. In essence, there isn't that much difference. You still need to know before you go. I need to know, you need to have the right knowledge for sizing both on-prem and public cloud. If you don't have that knowledge, and if you don't know before you go, then, user experience might be shitty, or you pay too much, or both.
Yeah. Last one is the customers I'm talking to is mainly the differentiator on that ballpark, because they're still sizing in a way they used to on an on-premise environment, and that one is scaled to use all your hardware that's bought.
Yep.
If you do that in cloud, there is a lot of hardware over there. So if you're going to scale out instead of up, you probably end up with a huge, huge bill of cloud consumption.
Yeah.
A colleague of mine calls it a micro waste. So imagine you can just, imagine you have a machine in Azure with 8 gigs of RAM, because you believe that is the right fit, or you maybe didn't size properly, or you didn't know properly. And you have thousands of these machines. While maybe not 8 gigs of RAM was sufficient, but maybe 6 or 4 gigs of RAM was fine. And you save $10 per machine a month. For 1,000 machines for a couple of years, that's a lot of money. So micro waste is part of that public cloud sizing exercise. And has direct connection to cost.
But the difference with cloud is you can easily scale up, right? So on-prem, you need to buy extra hardware. But in cloud, you can just say, all right, 6 gigabytes of RAM, it's not enough if you're a year further and your consumption has grown, you can just add a little bit of RAM, pay a little bit more per month, and you're fine. But with hardware on-prem, that's different. You need to buy extra hardware.
So the other side, like the new hardware, like if you look at the new AMD GPUs, that hardware every Intel Moore's Law applies to AMD as well. That's funny. But the hardware, the performance and the cost, like hardware performance doubles and cost downscales heavily. So 3 years from now, you have new server equipment, which is even more powerful than you have today, obviously.
So if I may ask, and of course, we know the flexibility that a public cloud has to offer. And one of the topics on the upcoming webinar is, of course, the advantages and limits of an on-premises and public clouds for VDI and DAS. But and I already addressed the on-premises VDI solutions as a maybe legacy or traditional, well, not legacy, definitely not, sorry, but traditional approach maybe. But what are the advantages of an on-premises solution compared to any public cloud solution, a DAS solution running on a public cloud?
So the advantages of on-prem, you mean, right? Yes.
Yeah.
There was one funny thing that Ruben mentioned, and I even didn't know that, because for an example, in Azure, you have reserved instances. And reserved, if you reserve a seat to go to dinner, you are guaranteed to have a place, right, to sit down at a certain time. But a reserved instance in Azure doesn't mean it's there for you. You only pay up front. So you only tell, all right, I want to utilize this, so your costs go down. But it doesn't mean there is space for you.
It doesn't mean there is a guarantee. It's not guaranteed. Yeah, the word guarantee is important.
Guarantee, there's no capacity. Guaranteed for you.
I think there was a huge gap in there in April, where we actually, the hyperscaler Azure was done, complete, full capacity.
Yeah. So they should listen to Rody, right? Never size on 100% utilization. Make sure you have some headroom for future growth.
To come back to Yitz's question, like in that simple example, one single example, if like public cloud is the like business continuity strategy, and for whatever reason it's not about Azure, but for whatever reason your like infrastructure platform you want to consume cannot guarantee these resources. Now what? So that can be a reason to say, well, I want to use certain amount of resource on-prem, or in this type of scenario, I want to use a second data center, or in this type of scenario, maybe I want to use a second hyperscaler. That could be a scenario as well.
Yep.
Well, and maybe, of course, well, you're working for Nutanix, and you came from Frame, or was still focusing on XiFrame, of course. This was a public cloud offering only at first, right? So and making the shift towards a public cloud offering as well as an on-premises solution as well. And maybe there are other reasons behind that, but for sure, there are customers who were asking for this solution. Otherwise, you wouldn't waste any time.
I think what you're trying to say, hey, after the acquisition of Frame by Nutanix, hey, is that a coincidence that AHV, like on-prem support, was being added? No, of course it's not a coincidence. There is like clear demand for on-prem, and not because it's Nutanix customers or Nutanix partners, but in general there are pros and cons to run workload machines on-prem or in public cloud. That's not rocket science. And when you're a small startup like Frame in the beginning, you cannot do like five things at once. You focus on a thing like on public cloud, public cloud service, and you want to differentiate yourself in that space. And then over time, additional public cloud vendors being added and then including on-prem environment. But I know for sure when I joined Frame, so long before Nutanix acquired Frame, I think my second week in Serbia where I met the engineers, I've seen Frame running on-prem. And it was like 2 years before Nutanix acquired us. So I knew from a technology perspective that it's possible, and it's just a matter of the right timing to make it happen. So.
Yeah, that might be a nice segue into Windows 10 multi-session. I spoke to a couple of performance testers who already had the ability to test Windows 10 multi-session before we even know what it was. Yeah. And they tested it in their own data center. And to my belief, Microsoft announced this last October or April that they're going to expand the Windows 10 multi-session to Azure Stack, which is their on-prem solution to extend their Azure hyperscaler.
Yeah.
Azure Stack Hub, to be precise, who know so far not many people use. unfortunately.
No, to my beliefs, there is the hardware's requirements are pretty high and badass. But the segue into Windows 10 multi-session, why this is not the future?
According to the abstract of the webinar, right?
Yeah.
All in caption, so.
Yeah, it's two things, right? Maybe you want to start. All good.
Yeah, I think first of all, people see it the same. They look to the same way to it as they look to a server OS like Server 2019, and they size it even the same. But it's completely different because it's a client OS made multi-session. So it consumes a lot of more resources than a server OS. So there's a key differentiator in terms of sizing, first of all. And then I think we discussed this because I didn't know the complete situation, but there are certain limitations who can use Windows 10 multi-user. So I thought it needs to be running on Azure because that's one of the limits. You only can run it on Azure. You can't run it on-prem, on Azure Stack Hub. But you can't run it on AWS. You can't run it on Google Cloud. That's not allowed. You can't run it on a normal hypervisor. Well, technically you can, but it's not allowed. But the other part is I thought, hey, why doesn't Frame support, for example, support Windows 10 multi-user? But Ruman told me that you need to be certified as a solution partner to utilize Windows 10 multi-user. So there are so many limitations to the product that from a technology perspective, I don't understand, right? So
I'm not sure if it's a limitation to product. It's just a direction Microsoft is taking. And that's their choice and fair choice. And Microsoft entering the DAS space with WVD is a healthy thing for all of us in our space.
Sure,
And Windows 10 multi... multi-session or multi-user, depending who you ask, is in general a good thing. It's a much faster update cycle compared to Windows Server. That's a good thing. It's better aligned with the traditional Win 10 client OS.
Same application compatibility.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, in that same direction. Exactly. I think the biggest challenge, and that's why this sort of provoking sort of title was created, is that I think the biggest challenge longer term is that customers or partners have less choice, because what Rody described is that Windows 10 can only be used when you're in the sort of the Microsoft silo, which is, I would say, not bad or good, but it's just another silo. It's just a silo. What if you want to be? What if you want to have choice for whatever reason? Maybe you don't want to be connected to that, or maybe you want to have choice for continuity reasons, and you want to use Azure, or you want to use Google, or you want to use AWS, or you want to use on-prem. So you want to have choice based on your requirements. And then, with Win 10 multi-user, multi-session as there's today, choice is very limited. So I truly believe that choice and competition is a healthy thing for Microsoft, for the industry, for customers and partners. And with Win 10, I'm more restricted to use that great OS, and that's the reality as of today. And maybe that will change in the future. We'll see, and I hope that it will change in the future so that all can benefit from that great OS.
Yeah.
But Rody, you mentioned you have a better application compatibility because it's Windows 10.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
But I think we still have to constrain that if the application is not aware that's multi-user. Like we had in the server-based computing space.
I think from a technology perspective, it's a bit different because in Windows Server OS, there are many shared processes. Mm-hmm. With Windows 10 multi-user, all those processes run in a user context and not in a system context. So from it's more a bubble per user, I think. So they're going to separate that more and more to enhance the security, but I think also to enhance the application compatibility. So you don't have those constraints like with the server OS. Mm-hmm. But the downside is the resource consumption, because you don't share the same processes, they need to run multiple times. and that consumes more CPU, RAM, and so on. So that's the difference you see there in terms also of sizing, that Windows 10 multi-user is more heavy than a Server OS. So I think that in terms of application compatibility, you're better off than with a server.
Yeah, but then again, and maybe, well, my experience is a little bit rusty in building such environments, to be honest, at least with a real application set of a customer. But how often lately do you run into situations where you run into compatibility issues with applications on a server operating system?
Yeah, not that many. Sometimes you do. But also, like, part of Microsoft's offer is that if there is an application compatibility issue in the Windows 10 multi-session, multi-user context, that they have a program, I think it's called App Assure, that they sort of, I wouldn't say guarantee, I'm not sure if that's the right word, but they for sure help, and they have people with tools to make that really shitty application work on a modern OS. So,
and maybe it's also about the support of the ISVs, right? I mean,
sure.
Yeah,
there are a lot of applications also today being used on a server operating system that officially are not supported by the ISVs. But
yeah.
I think what Rody mentioned in the beginning is that another challenge we talk about, like, public cloud, single user, multi user. One of the challenges I see in the field is that, like, Windows 10 client OS, so single user, it's not a technology conversation. It's more like a licensing, maybe a little bit boring, but a licensing conversation. So it's really tough to run a Windows 10 client OS on AWS or on Google, not because technology, but because, like, they're not part of an sort of licensing program or very limited in a program, which is like a challenge, and especially after 2025 with Office 365 and support for Windows Server. Yeah, then, like, what's the future of, like, what is the future of Windows Server in an DAS world when you cannot run or very limited run Windows 10 in another cloud like Amazon or Google or Adi Cloud or maybe Oracle Cloud, and you cannot use Windows 10 multi-user in that cloud. And you can only use Windows Server, and then Office 365 is challenged with Windows Server after 2025. So that's why you asked, hey, that's why the future of Windows 10 multi-user is challenging, because these non-tech topics, but these more like licensing and partnership and, like, yeah, sort of David and Goliath type of conversation. So.
Yeah. I don't know if it's the same for you, Ruben, but I'm in a lot of conversations with my customer about on this topic, and you, from a frame perspective, I can understand that this will be as well, because the customers I talk to, they already have the E3 or E5 licensing model. They say, yeah, we get WVD for free. It's never for free, but these are the words they gave to me. So
it's not built separately.
So why do we actually need, for instance, a Citrix or a VMware? Why does Nerdio exist or a Wingo?
Simple answer, because there are gaps in a product, or there are gaps in the execution of strategy, or there are gaps in a timeline. And these gaps can be big or can be small, depending on how you look at it. And if you're a customer or partner and you have a certain request and you look for a solution, and if that solution fits your use case, great. But if there are gaps in that solution and therefore it doesn't meet your requirements, then, okay, what do you do? Well, you team up with Citrix, or you team up with Nutanix or with Nerdio, or, like, whatever the ecosystem partner is in that context. And that's how it is for 20 years, so 20 plus years. That's how I started with Citrix 20 years ago. And every year you will get the conversation, and, you know, I think that's what you have, Eric, as well. Like, every time, like, hey, what's the value add of Citrix or Microsoft? And it's not about Citrix or Microsoft, but that's the question you will have. What's the value add of Frame in this context? What's the value add of VMware in this context? Yeah, that's our job, to explain and to listen and to explain. And sometimes to say no, or sometimes to say yes, big time, exclamation mark. But our job is to listen first, and then understand the ecosystem, and then understand, like, the challenges, understand the requirements, and then match a solution.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the key topics in all of our different things we discuss in the webinar is just to fact check and to have the knowledge to know what you want and what you get, so you can make the right decision if it's DAS or on-prem or whatever you want, but look into all the different options they have and just compare them.
What we also discussed, what Rory and I discussed, is sometimes like the engineering approach, and there's nothing wrong with the engineering approach, but you can also overstretch that by imagine the feedback is, I want to have 1 year to spend to size and spec everything in detail, because that's my engineering approach. Yep. And after a year, you said, okay, this is the sizing, this is how it should be, this is the business case, all good. But in that year, maybe the company changed, or maybe the application landscape changed, or maybe the OS platform changed. So there, you need to find the right balance between speed and effectiveness in that sizing context. So yeah, that's one of the downsides. That's not only for sizing, but also around this conversation. You can have lengthy conversations for weeks, months. But sometimes you just need to execute. And the beauty of cloud is that you can start small, and increase fast, or start small and just stop without too much of an issue.
Yeah. So and exactly as you said, right? You can start small, but for example, you are a running an organization. You're the head of IT, or maybe even the CTO. I don't know. You're having this on-premises environment, and you need to you're making the first steps in towards a DAS solution, or at least you're starting leverage the resources that a public cloud has to offer. Mm-hmm. One of your topics is data locality, right? How do you address, especially in such a transitioning phase, how would you address this this challenge?
Well,
start with you, Rody, first.
It depends on what you're going to do first in cloud, right? So if you're a small step and an easy step to go to DAS or cloud is SaaS, right? So take a application. Ask your application supplier, hey, can I get it as a service? If you have, for example, a help desk system, Topdesk, and you run it on-prem, it's quite easy to just take it as a service. That's your first small step into SaaS. It's very, very limited. And then you can get some knowledge about, hey, how does that work? What is my role? Because your role from a hoster to a more of a project leader, right? So you have to talk to the supplier, like, hey, it's not working, can you help out, instead of turning some knobs and hey, it's working again. So that's the first small step. But if you go further and further, you have to look at, where is my data and where's my user? And especially when you have a desktop in the cloud and an on-prem application, which is, so to say, legacy. It isn't designed to go via a connection with latency. In my previous role at a different company, we had an application which didn't run on Wi-Fi. So how would that run if my desktop is in Azure and my application is on-prem? Because you have more latency than Wi-Fi. So yeah, really have to look at your own set of applications. And if you want to do a desktop in the cloud with your legacy application, then you need to move your legacy application to the user in the cloud as well. But that's a big step. So yeah, it's hard to say you have to do this or have to do that. It really depends on what your situation is.
And also depends, like, if you ask, hey, where's my data? The next question should be, what do you mean with data, and what kind of data sources do you mean? Are we talking about OneDrive or Dropbox or Google Drive or Box? Is that where you store your data?
We still love those network shares.
Yeah. Or are you talking about network shares indeed? Yeah, your folders, your home directory, your group directory. Are we talking about databases? Are we talking about like BIM 360 type of approaches? What is the application requirement for that? How does the application perform over a stretch network, where app and data is disconnected? These type of topics determine, hey, what is the data strategy? And there's no single answer because there is no single data source. There is data in OneDrive or Dropbox. There's data in a file server. There's data in my database server. And how is the application designed? Yeah. And then you design, okay, then you divide, okay, what is my plan for the future? And so the data topic is very well connected to the application delivery topic. Because if we forget that these topics are or should be connected, then you will get a shitty application and even a shitty user experience. And that's often we focus on like the VDI, DAS, application delivery part with sizing of workload machines. And then we forget about the data conversation. The data conversation is even more challenging because that's bound to how the application is designed and works. And sometimes you cannot change that easily. That's what I see a lot in the field.
And if you go multi-geo, right? So if you go, somebody is logging in from Japan and the other one is from logging in from the States, where do you store your data if they use the same application?
Yeah, a good example, I work a lot of with like engineering firms or design firms. And for instance, they use Revit and they have like a global workforce with three geolocations, but they want to share the files. Well, you could say, well, we'll use Nutanix files or we'll use Azure files. Maybe, but what if there is no decent locking of files? Or maybe there is too strict of locking of files and the whole project is being locked. And there are smart solutions like Lanazuni or Panzura, BIM 360, who can be very smart with like applications, files, and file locking in a geo-distributed scenario as well. So understanding these type of solutions are helpful and also important to solve this data locality challenge, actually.
But Rody mentioned already, first look at, is this application as a web app or a SaaS app?
Yep.
What is the purpose of a virtualized desktop or desktop as a service when... and this is kind of a long shot. Everything is a web or SaaS app.
Yeah, then we can retire, Erik.
Yeah.
Well, you can start developing your own web browser, maybe.
Yeah.
No, of course. Like if the scenario is like everything is web and everything is mobile, and you just log in with a modern identity platform. If that is the reality for that company, yeah. Then the need to run classic Windows apps or Windows desktops is very limited.
It's gone.
Yeah. But the reality is different. The reality is different.
Yeah.
And the reality is different now in 5 years and also maybe in 10 years. We'll see. We'll listen to the podcast when we are old and grumpy and see.
And what I'm afraid of is that people easily go to SaaS apps, but they don't think about how to get away from them. What happens with my data if I want to move from supplier A to supplier B because they have a better product or better price? How to move my data to another software vendor in SaaS? How do I extract it?
Should be part of the intake, too.
And also believe that the easy apps, like the easy Windows apps, are already converted to mobile or SaaS.
Yeah.
The challenging apps we see on Windows, virtual or physical, are like the deeply integrated apps or the like high demanding applications or maybe like really legacy apps where it's not profitable to rewrite the application and it's really tough to sort of transform that app to a SaaS platform. And that's the reality today for many of us.
So in essence, for those organizations who are in this transitioning phase from a on-premises towards a cloud solution, well, of course, the SaaS applications can be a huge relief in that transitioning phase. For those applications with a multi-tier configuration where you have the data locally, whether that's on a share or on a database or whatsoever, you need to make this cutover decision if SaaS application is not available. But every app needs its own strategy, in essence, whenever you're in such a transitioning phase. And you really need to make sure that, well, your data is there where also the application is to offer a good user experience.
Yeah.
At least that's how I've been raised in a terminal server with change user / install.
That's why I believe the like hybrid approach where you have choice from an application and data perspective in an on-prem or public cloud scenario makes sense. And that's not only... because like I work for Nutanix, but if you look at what Amazon is doing or what Erik said earlier, what Microsoft is doing, they also make a transition from public cloud to on-prem? Why is Azure Stack Hub available? Or why is Outpost available? Well, because there is demand for data on-prem and applications on-prem, and there's demand for data and applications in cloud. That's called hybrid. And some vendors have a starting point of public cloud and move to on-prem, and other vendors have the other way around. And there are pros and cons for both.
So a little bit changing gears here, right? So there was one topic as well, and that's network bandwidth latency. And Rody, since you were introduced as the fiber over bamboo guy, and I know in your previous employer you had this nice experience with a limited bandwidth but high latency connection as well. So what kind of advice and what kind of mistakes to avoid when it comes to bandwidth? What is it that you're going to share on the webinar about this?
Well, one of the main things is that user experience is not only defined by bandwidth. So when you talk about user experience in a remoting scenario, people often think directly about bandwidth, but there are so many different factors that can lead to a shitty UX. It's not only bandwidth, because latency and packet loss is, I think, even more, if you talk in terms of network, more heavy on the user experience than bandwidth. Because with bandwidth, you can just lower the image quality, and most of the times people won't even notice it. But if you have massive packet loss, how will you get a good user experience? And one of the other things is that, and Ruben got this question, I think, almost daily, how much bandwidth do I need, or how much bandwidth will it use?
Yeah.
How can you answer that without they tell you what their context is? So what applications do you use? Even what's your connection? Because if you have a 100 megabit connection and there's enough bandwidth, every remoting protocol will just use 100 megabit and give you the best user experience. But that doesn't mean that a user with 1 megabit will get the same user experience. So you need to have the context of all the different components that have a part in this. So it's very hard to tell what you need.
Yeah, the problem, and we all are in like consulting business or been in consulting business, is on one side you don't want to answer that question with like "it depends," but on the other side we need to answer that question with "it depends," and then like fast. Add context and add value in that conversation, because if you just shut your mouth after "it depends," it doesn't add value. But if you explain what Rody mentioned, okay, what is the user expectation? What is the baseline? What is the user activity? What are the applications he or she is using?
Yeah.
What are the resource requirements of these apps? What kind of remoting protocol do you use? What are the capabilities of the protocol? What is the endpoint? What is the resolution? What's the monitor? What's the monitor configuration? What's the network configuration? What are the network? What are the remoting protocol settings? Is it WiFi 4.4.4, 60 frames per second, built to lossless, microphone enabled, USB enabled? If it's all enabled, then the response is it depends based on the list I just sort of summed up. And if you understand what "it depends" means, that means education and knowledge transferred to the colleagues or the customer and partner who asks. Then they understand the context better, and then you can have a decent conversation.
Yeah,
and everyone is looking for a sort of table with numbers, like, hey, Citrix HDX with this app will consume, I just make up a number, 500 kbps for XYZ, or RDP XYZ as well. But the challenge is that with these numbers, this table, it's just part of the story. Because if I say browsing websites will roughly consume 1.5 mbps per session, and you will size for that, it doesn't say that much about what the real user experience will be. So in our...
What website is he visiting?
Yeah, it could be as well. Exactly.
YouTube or just say Hello World page.
Yep.
Right?
Exactly. So that's our story as well, is that you need to combine telemetry data, so network utilization, CPU utilization, GPU utilization, maybe disk utilization in some degree, and combine that with what the user will experience on his or her screen.
Yeah,
and if you have that combined, then you can have a decent conversation about sizing and connect it with user experience. That's like the full circle. And many of us, in our industry, many of the vendors in our industry focus just on like the table with applications and like network configuration and forget like what the user experience will be or might be in that that setup. So that's like sort of our call to action to all of us, like combine telemetry data with user experience. Do a Pepsi Cola, Coca-Cola test or record the user experience with a video frame grabber or whatever makes sense, do a survey to connect user experience with telemetry data.
Yeah, and know that if your baseline of your or your conditions change, that you need to relook at your settings. So if you run from a on-prem, everybody in-house using Thin clients or whatever, no, bandwidth is not an issue, latency is not an issue, and then COVID-19 happens and everybody's starting to work from home with shitty conditions, yeah, you need to rethink your strategy and check if their user experience is still okay-ish.
I remember a phrase. The former CTO from Login Consultants mentioned, Jeroen van der Kamp, and he said the success of a VDI project is measured by the user adoption.
Yep.
And on the bombshell.
Yeah, and that has nothing to do with sizing per se, and not like a technology exercise. No. That's part of that conversation, but also managing expectations and adding that user in that process is a fundamental mistake.
Yeah,
and it's not a one-time assessment.
No,
as Rody mentioned, it's a continuous process. So when I ask you the question, when you're designing or configuring and sizing an environment for the next 3 to 5 years, once it's finished and you have the project being signed off, the work starts over, right? So
So one of the last mistakes we have on our slide, I think it's the last because it's the last topic we talk about, UX, it's size once and forget forever. So I think that nothing changes. Those years.
I think we have to wrap it up. Final question before we wrap things up. Is there anything you want to come back to or maybe emphasize?
Well, I have a final question before you answer that question. Of course, well, there it's very likely, or at least we're trying to achieve to publish this podcast before you do the webinar on the end of this month. So where can people sign up for this webinar?
Yeah.
Because they want to know more, right?
Yep. Yeah, it will be easy one. Just check Rody, Carson, or Ruben's LinkedIn feed daily, hourly, every minute, and then we'll publish the link there.
Yeah.
It's an external provider who sets up this this platform and the webinar. I will share the link. I don't have it with me here right now, but I will share with you guys so you can add it to the podcast note. And also on LinkedIn, for sure, we will make some noise around that.
So keep a close eye on LinkedIn or Twitter or any other socials of Ruben and Rody and make sure to catch that.
Sleep in front of their house.
Yeah. if you listen to the podcast after September 30th, no worries. Normally it works. Like if you just sign up, you will get the recording of that webinar anyway. So if you cannot make it live, no worries. Recording is available. So.
But remember, this is where you heard it first.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, then thank you all for listening. I hope you enjoyed this snack as we try to serve you the right amount of EUC for your appetite. If you have anything you want to add here or just want to stay in touch, reach out to us on the social channels or by email on podcast@euc-digest.com. Cheers, love, and rockets.
This podcast is brought to you by Liquidware. Liquidware is the leader in adaptive workspace management solutions for Windows desktops. Their products cover all facets of management to ensure the ultimate user experience across all workspaces, physical, virtual, DAS, or cloud.